I'm John Kroll. On today's No Limits, we're going to talk about the challenges presented by having ex-offenders re-enter society. There's a conference next week to address re-entry issues. We will talk about what the problems are and why helping former prisoners rejoin the workaday world matters. My guests are Brian Reeder of the Mayor's Office of Reentry, Lena Hackett of Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards, Executive Director of Public Advocates in Community Reentry, or PACE. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about reentry issues. By reentry, we mean ex-offenders rejoining both the workforce and society after they have left incarceration. The hooks here are that there's a conference on reentry issues next week, and the mayor's office here in Indianapolis has received a grant to assist with reentry programs. If you'd like to join this important conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Brian Reeder, who is with the Mayor's Office of Reentry, Lena Hackett, who's with Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards, who is the Executive Director at PACE. That's Public Advocates in Community Reentry. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. Well, Brian, I think I'm going to start with you. Could you talk a little bit first about the grant that the mayor's office has received, and then the conference next week?
Well, we have had an opportunity to apply for a second chance grant that was awarded to the community in the amount of about $730,000. And basically, it's dealing with high-risk, moderate to high-risk individuals that are returning back to Marion County. We are targeting age group of 18 to 25. Living in the focus areas that have been really designated by the Department of Public Safety, along with looking at some of the zip codes that are actually involved with the individuals as they return back to Indianapolis. The grant is going to provide pre-release and post-release services to about 100 participants. Those services will be evidence-based practices, and they will include comprehensive reentry plans, all the kinds of wraparound services that are necessary for our returning citizens to be successful as they come back to Indianapolis. One of the things that was said to me early on was that everyone who commits a crime is not a criminal. Some people make bad choices, and I think sometimes we miss that point in trying to make sure that the people that are returning back to Indianapolis have a level playing ground, so to speak, after they pay their debt to society. So we've been working really hard to try to make sure that that comes about. This grant is going to really help us to be able to reach in and really look at what kinds of services are going to be necessary for our returning citizens to be successful.
Talk to me about the conference next week. And I'd welcome Lena and Rhiannon to jump in, too.
Yeah, I tell you what, I started this job approximately, 13 months ago? And basically, I had some experience with jails and prisons. I was involved with a prison ministry called Kairos Prison Ministry. We went into all the prisons in Indiana. And so I had an understanding of individuals as they get ready to come out of incarceration, what kinds of anxiety they were really feeling about coming back to Indianapolis, and I think, or really just getting out of prison. And I think the misconception is that prison in some ways is not conducive to a person wanting to get out. Mm-hmm. I think that's a misconception. I've not talked to one individual, and I've talked to many, that have said, you know, I'd rather stay here than go home. And so I think what we have to understand is 90% of the people who are currently incarcerated are coming back to their communities. Mm-hmm. And that's all over the country. That's not just in Indianapolis. And so this conference really is really key in that it helps to identify those individuals, whether they be large agencies like Rhiannon's agency PACE or small mom and pop agencies that really have a heart for the returning citizens. And I'm going to stop there and let you guys kick in because I could talk about this all day.
Yeah, give me some of the logistical details about the conference, who all is participating and, you know, what dates, all of that.
Sure. The conference is next Thursday, and we have capacity for 400 folks to attend, and we are beyond capacity. So the purpose of the conference is, as Chris had said, to really look at who's delivering services and how can we help build their capacity to do that. Because a lot of folks are working only in their agencies and they don't have the ability to get higher level training, skill training. And so what we heard from people who were serving this population is we really need to build our skills and broaden what we can do. So the conference is a professional conference and focused on skill building so people can go to motivational interviewing classes. They can learn more about the culture of reentry. They can learn about data and how to prove their programs effective. And this is the second year that the Marion County Reentry Coalition has partnered with the city to do it. Last year, we had about 350 folks attend. This year, looks like we're going to have a little over 400 folks attending. And it really is in addition to the professional opportunities, the ability for folks to network with each other is enormous. And what they learn from each other is invaluable.
Rhiannon, what accounts for that? I mean, obviously, it's always dangerous when journalists do math. But, you know, you move from 350 to 400, that's somewhere between a 10 and a 15% jump in attendance rates. And the fact new programs generally don't grow quite that rapidly, that indicates that there is a hunger for this sort of instruction and support. What accounts for that?
I think as service providers, most service providers are not like PACE, where they only serve this population. They serve a neighborhood or a community. But everyone's starting to realize that a number of the people that they're already serving have felony convictions, and they're understanding that they have very unique needs that are different than the average individual. They can't go to public housing and things like that. So I think that it's actually a very good sign that service providers are acknowledging, hey, I need to build my skills in working with this population so that I can be more effective. Because if you don't have those necessary skills, you're not going to be able to make good progress within this community.
You know, and I would say the other thing we've seen with the folks who have registered for this year's conference is we have a higher percentage of people who work in the criminal justice system who are coming to this conference because folks in the criminal justice system are now realizing that it's those community reentry skills that are going to ensure that people don't come back to them.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the challenges associated with having ex-offenders reenter society and the workforce. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Rhiannon, I'm going to stay with you for a second. Talk to me a little bit about what some of the challenges of the typical person who has been released from prison faces. You know, and we can talk about, I'm sure that there are going to be breakdowns, whether it's someone who's been a nonviolent offender or someone who's been a violent offender. Gender probably plays a role. Age plays a role. Race probably plays a role. And we'll get to all of that. But give me the broad overview first.
The broad overview is the felony is really like a scarlet letter that people don't really understand. There are a lot of things that they are not allowed to do. You know, even with the most mild felony conviction, they have to figure out what employers will accept anyone with a felony conviction. They have to figure out what apartments will allow them to live there with a felony conviction. A lot of organizations have a blanket policy that says if you have a criminal history, you can't live here or you can't work here. And so even a low level, you know, charge can keep you from living in a certain apartment complex. And so it's very hard to come back and turn your life around and not go back to what you used to be in when you're limited to, you know, a certain profession or a certain housing area. So that's kind of where our organization comes in, is navigating them to help figure out where they can go and help educating the community that every charge is not the same. If you're a warehouse and you're worried about theft, then maybe someone with a theft conviction is not what you are interested in. But what about a DUI? Or, you know, there's a lot of other factors that come into play, and people just don't realize that. There's a lot of stigma with not even with going to prison, with having a criminal background. And you'd be surprised how many people have a criminal background for doing something that each and every one of us probably did at some point in time and didn't get caught or didn't realize it was a charge, or we were just really good at what we were doing. So it's just difficult. So the and like you said, it, male, female, longer prison sentence, that does come into play. But in reality, just having that background, just when they say we pull a criminal history, it's immediate, you know, terror for that individual. They're like, what are they going to take? What won't they take? What does this mean for me?
How many people does your organization serve?
We serve an average of 1,500 new clients, and then we have about 2,000 existing clients.
Is that annually or is
annually?
Okay.
Annually. And what they need from us really ranges. Some people come in, they just need a job. We get them the job. They're okay. They're good. Some people need really intense services. So everyone is different. So our program is very individualized to the client to help them get whatever they need. And some people don't need a job. Some people need long-term treatment, and they may need to be on disability, or some people, I mean, everyone is very different in what they need. And I think that's what makes us successful, is we don't just let every client come in and say, oh, you need a job, because they don't. You need to figure out, how did they get in the position to commit that crime and fix whatever was broken there so that they don't, you know, that doesn't happen again.
I'm trying to get, by my math, then you're serving at any given time about 3,500 people.
Yes.
With the 2,000 existing, 1,500. Trying to give listeners an idea of how many people we're talking about here when we talk about ex-offenders. Do we have numbers on that? Brian, you jerked your head back, which tells me, while it's effective in interpersonal communications, doesn't work so well over the radio.
Radio, right.
Yeah.
Well, last year, we had 8,000. In November, we had 8,000 that returned to Indianapolis.
Just in November?
From December. From January to the following November. So that was about, 11 months. We had an additional 800 that had been targeted to be released in December. So we're looking at about 9,000 people that came back to Marion County last year.
So basically the size of a small town.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
Because that number then increases when we start to think about, you have over 40,000 people that are involved in the criminal justice system in Marion County that do not necessarily go to the Department of Corrections. So those individuals, if they're staying an extended period of time in the jail, say 10 days, will now be reentrance, because after 10 days of not reporting for work, usually you do not have a job when you get ready to get out. Mm-hmm. And so then that starts to put stress on the other economic indicators in terms of your housing, dealing with, you know, all of the things that go along with just you being a citizen in Indianapolis. So at that point, you've got another, say out of that 40,000, let's say we're only talking about another 10%. So that's another 4,000. And then on top of that, we've had what was called House Bill 1006, which changed the whole criminal justice system so that now any felony six individuals or anybody that has a D felony from the old system is not going back, which is looking like it's going to be an additional about 4,000 people. So we're looking at 16,000 to 17,000 people that we're going to have to service in Marion County over the next few years.
So it's moved from a small town to a good sized bedroom,
yes,
community, basically.
That's correct.
Of people who, you know, and if we were talking about this in international terms, Lena, they almost sound like displaced persons, you know, and that they kind of wander around and don't have an obvious path to engage.
And even the most motivated of them hit so many barriers because in addition to everything Rhiannon spoke about, there's criminal justice barriers in terms of where do they have to report? Do they have to leave work to do some kind of report for probation or for community corrections? So they have special conditions that don't mesh with communities and society that they have to navigate. And that in itself, those things just make it really difficult for even the most motivated of individuals to be successful.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the reentry of ex-offenders in Indianapolis and Marion County. My guests are Brian Reeder, who's with the Mayor's Office of Reentry, Lena Hackett, who's with Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards, who's the Executive Director of PACE. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the issue of reentry of ex-offenders, people who have spent time behind bars and are attempting to become part of civilian outside life again. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Brian Reeder, who is with the Mayor's Office of Reentry, Lena Hackett, who is with Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards, who is with who is the Executive Director of PACE, that's Public Advocates in Community Reentry. We were talking about sort of the larger issues of affecting reentry, and it established that it affects far more people than the public's probably aware of. That, you know, once you start totaling up the numbers, you get pretty quickly just in Marion County to a figure approaching 20,000 people, and we wanted to break that down. I probably should ask, you know, is the effect or the challenge of reentry issues disproportionate for Marion County, or is this a statewide challenge? Are there other places that are affected heavily? Is it more an urban than a rural problem? Lena, you made the mistake of making eye contact.
See, I turned away. So.
Yeah.
It is a disproportionate impact on Marion County for a couple of reasons. One, just the population is so large in Marion County, and then the system is so complicated in Marion County. So it's not an easy system to get your arms around right away. You know, you're talking 26 judges and, you know, a robust community corrections and probation and parole, where in a smaller community, those partners are much smaller and much easier to bring together. You know, the Marion County Reentry Coalition, which we coordinate, has been around for about 7 years, and it really is a coalition. It's not an entity, and what it does is bring those folks all into the same room. And you know, very interestingly, they don't know each other because it is such a big system. But by bringing them all into the same room, they can work on strategies together that have really taken the 12-month and 6-month return to incarceration rates down in this community. But you know, it's like swimming upstream because the numbers, keeping low-level felons in our community, which has started, is going to have a huge impact on the numbers, and none of those systems that serve them are any bigger than they were before.
What do you mean by low-level felons and keeping them in our communities?
So when Chris referred to House Enrolled Act 1006, what it does is instead of people, these low-level felons, going to the Department of Corrections, we keep them locally. So they're either at the jail or they're in community corrections or they're on probation. So they're not going to leave Marion County. So right now, we've looked at the court data. That's going to be close to 4,000 people a year. And yet the systems aren't any bigger than they were before. So there's no more capacity at the jail, no more capacity in community corrections, no more capacity in community-based organizations like Rhiannon. But there's going to be this influx of folks who need to be served.
How much of this, I mean, there is this public perception, and to some degree it's a political perception, that, you know, there is a trial. You know, if someone is found guilty, there is a conviction, and that solves the problem. But what I'm hearing from all three of you is, no, it doesn't solve the problem. What it does is it solves one problem. Mm-hmm. It removes that person from being, you know, an immediate threat to the rest of the civilian population. But it creates a whole nother set of problems, or creates might not be the right word, defers a whole nother set. And, you know, it doesn't sound like we focus as much on that second set of problems as we do on the first. Rhiannon and Lena, you're both nodding your heads. So I'm going to give Rhiannon the first crack at this and then go to Lena.
You're exactly right. And I think the main problem that we see is that we're not rehabilitating the individuals. So we convict them. They do their time for the offense that they did or had some part in. But there's no rehabilitation. So you put them out in the community and then you expect them to never commit another crime. But what have you done to fix whatever caused them to commit the crime in the beginning? So what Lena's saying is if we have these 4,000 individuals in the community now, the rehabilitation has to happen in the community. And rehabilitation doesn't just mean you're on probation or community corrections or in Marion County Jail. You have to be getting some sort of service that's going to help you be a better person, be self-sufficient, not commit crime. So we're up against a problem that we haven't had previously where we've got to find more diverse services that can help rehabilitate them while they're in the community. And you can't just say the criminal justice providers have to do it. It's, you know, the whole reentry community has to come together and figure out what are we going to do to provide the service in the community.
What is the level of coordination, though, between jails and prisons and the reentry community? Well, I'm gathering it's not great from the visual cues.
I'll jump in here. And the reason is right. Because what we've tried to do over the last 13 months is to foster that collaboration between the state as well as the jail. And so I've talked to a lot of people in the state in terms of reentry. They have a reentry area that's designated for the reentrants to come in. However, it was heretofore I was not aware of any activity between, say, for instance, the county or the city level and the state level. And so we initiated that and started to talk with them along with the city county counselors that have really shown an interest in this kind of issue that we're dealing with. And then we also are talking consistently with the jail. One of the things that we've also been involved in is we've been involved with jail returning individuals. And so we've been able to work with the jail and also with the criminal justice agencies, regardless of whether that is probation or community corrections. We're involved in talking and discussing what kinds of things can we do really to mitigate all of those circumstances that really face the individuals that come back. So even though we haven't really, what I would say, actually constructed that at this point, we have begun to look at how we can construct it. We've talked with individuals with Department of Corrections. We currently have an agreement with them that those individuals that are returning to Indianapolis will all be sent to Putnamville, one of the facilities that's not too far away. At that point, we 2 years prior to their release, we will start then to make some assessments, talk with them, find out what kinds, not just a job. Mm-hmm. We found out that it's not just getting a job, but it's getting the kind of job that they're going to feel secure in and also that's going to benefit them in terms of them feeling satisfied about what they're doing in terms of earning a living. So in those kinds of situations, we're making those efforts and we're making those strides and we're seeing some low-hanging fruit right now in terms of being able to address some of those things.
Well, Lena, go ahead.
And I would just want to add to that. The Department of Correction is a beast of a bureaucracy and a system all in itself. But the Marion County Reentry Coalition, they were founding members of that coalition for Marion County, and they still participate because they get it that if Marion County doesn't go well, that's implications statewide. Mm-hmm. And so it is figuring out the logistics between a state-run organization who really, once somebody walks out the doors of Department of Corrections, they got they have no role or authority with those people anymore. So it's really trying to figure out that bridge to community. And they're in there. And we, from the Reentry Coalition's point of view, we have been able to move them to some action and get beyond some talk. But it is two systems that are completely oriented in different ways. So the interest is the same, and we're trying to move them so that the actions are aligned. Because ultimately, this is all about public safety. You know, there isn't anyone in the Reentry Coalition or in this room that wouldn't value or doesn't value public safety above anything else. So we got to make sure that we are helping folks be successful so that they are safe and strong in their communities, good fathers, good mothers, good family members, and that's what builds public safety.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the challenges presented by reentry of ex-offenders into mainstream society. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. Frank, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that I do work for a company here in Indiana that does hire felons. We have a gentleman that is employed at this time, was hired on part-time, and is such an exemplary employee that he has been hired on full-time, and he's got a great future ahead of him.
Well, thank you for calling and sharing that. Appreciate it. And, you know, since you're doing the right thing, if you want to give the name of the company, we'll let you do that as a public service.
I'd better not.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for the call.
All right.
Take care. Thanks. So that's got to be gratifying.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah, that's really great. And honestly, we have a lot of, at Pace, we have a lot of partner employers that hire our clients. So I do want to, it is an obstacle for them to find employment, but we help them get the necessary skills to be a good employee, and we have a lot of employers that hire them. So I do want to make sure that, you know, I make that known that we do have some really, really good employers.
This is a big question, so, and I'm going to ask all three of you to take a crack at it. But, you know, as Brian's pointed out, 90% of the people who go behind bars are going to come back out at some point. And since, you know, we lead the world in the number of people we have behind bars,
absolutely,
this is not an insignificant problem or challenge for us as a society. Is sort of the operating premise of our criminal justice system flawed in that, you know, reentry seems to be a concern that springs up only after the person gets out of prison, when we really should be thinking about it from the moment the person has been sentenced? You know, is there a need to look at this more holistically? And again, you're all nodding your head, so I know you all want to leap in on this one. I'm going to give Lena the first crack, then Rhiannon, and then Brian.
Thank you.
Yes, and you know, I have heard people say that reentry starts on day one of incarceration. What that looks like is different in every person's situation and in every correctional facility. You know, the goal is that when people are in prison serving their sentence, that whole mind frame that they have about what have they done, what do they want to do, what's the light at the end of the tunnel, it really comes down to mind frame. And, you know, one of the reasons this grant that we have is targeting 18 to 25-year-olds is because we find in that population, you know, they're 18 to 25. So even, you know, any 18 to 25-year-old, their brain hasn't developed yet. They're still out there. They're having a great time. Getting that mind frame to want to be successful and crime-free, that's the key. Because then they can hold a job and they can find housing and they're not going to reoffend. But it's a slippery wicket.
Well, and in some ways what we're talking about is the cliche is that all too often prison or incarceration, you know, the cliche is that it's a finishing school for career criminals, that if they were bad when they went in, they often emerge worse because there isn't a whole lot of correction that goes on.
Or it's a badge of honor. It's a cultural thing. You know, many people in their families have been incarcerated, so it's not an odd thing for them to be incarcerated. Or they're in a group or a gang where going to prison is actually a status. You know, so it's cultural, too, because we have imprisoned so many people for so many generations.
Rhiannon.
From what I see and from what I know about the system, it's not really built on rehabilitation, and that's the problem. In the beginning, when you're doing pre-sentence investigation and all the investigation that happens between the prosecutor and the public defender or the attorney and whoever else is involved in that, it doesn't focus on what's going to happen when the person gets out. It focuses on what kind of sentence should that person be serving, and that's what it should do for the crime. But there should be a part two that says, okay, well, when this person is out in 6 years, what are we going to do? What are we going to make this person do while they're incarcerated? What are we going to set up? And to me, that's the part that's missing. That part doesn't happen until they're wherever they're going to serve their sentence. And then we're just already behind the eight ball, in my opinion.
Brian.
Well, I come at it from a little different perspective in that if you have 60% of the people who are returning and they're either functionally illiterate or illiterate. Mm-hmm. And they have had, and 70% of those have never had a full-time job prior to their incarceration. So right there, I'm looking at maybe reentry should start prior to them getting in trouble.
Yeah.
Making sure that the educational basis and foundation is such that it helps them to realize that this is the proper way to move forth in this society, in this culture, and not from a criminal aspect of it. So I understand that, yes, once a person is incarcerated, and I agree with Rhiannon and Lena, that there have to be internal processes and protocols that are done while they're incarcerated to help rehabilitate. But the other thing is, you can't really force rehabilitation on a person if they're not willing to take that opportunity. Mm-hmm. Now, the 90% that come back, I don't know that we've ever really found out how many of those really use prison as a stepping stone to, I guess you could say, more violent crimes or a better criminal, so to speak. I don't know that that's something that we've ever found out. But I do know with my experience being behind the wall is that the majority of them want to come home. They want to be successful. They want to be reintegrated with their families. They only need an opportunity, and that's what has to happen prior to them being released.
We are talking about having ex-offenders reenter mainstream society. If you'd like to join the conversation, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named David has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Certainly.
I first would like to say thank you to those that are making the effort and doing the work to prepare the way or make efforts to prepare society for family members that are coming home. My son is currently incarcerated, has been for some part of the last 10 years.
Sorry, David.
The system is just one giant beast that is very difficult to deal with. It's something that unless you go behind those doors on a regular basis and experience, even as family members experience the antagonism of the system and then see the lack of socialization, the lack of contact that so many inmates experience. And I frequently speak to family friends and whoever will listen that these people will all get out someday, and we have done very little, if nothing, other than to antagonize them and their families and set up a system that is so difficult to deal with. And then we expect them to behave, to follow the rules, to get along and make a living. And it's just more difficult than most people understand.
Thank you very much for calling, David, and for sharing your story.
Thank you.
In just a couple of seconds, because we've got to go to a break, I'd like to talk, and actually we'll take this up because it's a larger subject after the break, but I would like for us to talk. We tend to think just of the offender, but David makes a valid point. There are a whole lot of other people who are affected by this, family members, friends, all of that, and I think we probably ought to give some consideration to that. We are talking about the challenges that ex-offenders face when they attempt to re-enter mainstream society after being behind bars. My guests are Brian Reeder of the Mayor's Office, Lena Hackett of Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards of PACE. That's Public Advocates in Community Reentry. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about the reentry of ex-offenders into mainstream society in anticipation of a conference next week, and the fact that the mayor's office has received two or three grants supporting this work now that is going to allow the mayor's office to focus in the city, basically to focus on these issues with still more vigor. My guests are Brian Reeder, who is with the Mayor's Office of Reentry, Lena Hackett, who is with Community Solutions Incorporated, and Rhiannon Edwards, who's the Executive Director of PACE, that's Public Advocates in Community Reentry. Just before we went to the break, we had a call from a man named David who was talking about how his son had spent the better part of a decade behind bars, and David made a point that we really haven't discussed in this program up to this point, that these reentry issues do not just affect the ex-offender. They affect family members. That can be parents, such as David. It can be spouses. It can be children. It can be siblings. It even can be the neighborhoods and friends that they emerge from. I'm not even sure how to frame the question. That's such a large, mm-hmm. when you think about the people who could be affected by this, how do we go about, talking to people and explaining what these challenges are, Rhiannon?
That's one of the main thing that my organization tries to really advocate on, is it's not just about the individual that committed the crime. It's also about their children and their spouses. And most importantly for us, their children. Their children are more than half as likely to go to prison when they have a parent that's been incarcerated. So when you're worrying about rehabilitating that individual, you have to think about what services are available to that child. So if you won't let this individual, because of their crime, live in this neighborhood or in this apartment complex, then their children can't live there either. So then where are the children going to live? In the bad neighborhood where the crime's committed, which again gives them more opportunity to be involved in that as they grow up. So for us, the main focus is the children and the family, because they are impacted by that. They are impacted by that stigma of the felony conviction. And I think as a community, we really have to understand that we can't just put them all on an island. We have to let them, be incorporated into our, bigger community.
One of the things that that we used to say when we went into Kairos is that, and it's really interesting, because I don't think a lot of times even the people who are incarcerated realize this, but it's like, you're not the only one doing time here. Your whole family is doing time with you. Your parents are doing time with you. Your friends are doing time with you. And so I think sometimes that's lost in the overall experience that says, I'm going to prison, mm-hmm. or I'm going to be in prison for a certain amount of time. And so just like what Dave was saying, it is hard on a parent to see their child incarcerated. I've been not
probably,
personally involved, but
probably hard on a child.
I've seen it. But we've been into the facilities where families have come in to see their dads, and what you see when they are, it's the time is up, and the child is being taken away, and he's crying. I want my daddy. I want my daddy. So it is a traumatic thing. It is not to be taken lightly.
Gotten an email from a listener named Doris. If you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Doris says, I am mentoring a woman who will be leaving prison at the end of November. Finding housing for women in supportive settings is very difficult, and especially if she has no substance abuse history. She is low risk and has excellent skills in food service, so a job should come fairly easily. Current information from the mayor's action line and 211 has led nowhere. Help. Brian, I think that's your cue there.
Well, we don't do direct services for the city, and the reason is because it takes a huge budget and a huge amount of personnel to do that. However, if Doris would like to give us a call, I'll give you the number. It's 317 327-4184. Our employment specialist is Damon Lane. And if the person that you're mentoring does have the skills that you have indicated, I think that we could probably help to at least get her on the right path. I will say this, the act of mentoring is one of the most successful ways of making sure that a person does not recidivate when they come out. Not only mentoring once they get out, but that the connection that she's made so far inside the prison, if that's something that she could continue, and I know sometimes there's different set of rules, even from DOC, and sometimes they say they don't want that to happen. But if there are mentors that can help walk those individuals through that whole transitioning period, those are the most successful people that we've seen.
Lena and Rhiannon, I'm going to give you a chance to toss out your numbers and your contact information if there are services you could provide someone who is reentering or some at least some counsel.
Yeah, we can definitely help at PACE. Our phone number is area code 317-612-6800. We have an orientation every Monday at 8:45, and she's welcome to just show up. Or if you want to call us now, Doris, we can start trying to work with her while she's still in the facility.
Do you have URLs to a website?
Yeah. www.paceindy.org.
Lena?
You know, and we would send someone straight to PACE.
Okay.
Because this is what they do for a living, and they are the folks who we believe does it in the most comprehensive manner.
We are talking about the challenges associated with reentry here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Randy, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to comment about the reentry. I am a convicted felon. I was out in 93. Before that, I had a professional license that I lost as a result of my conviction. I found the only industries open to me were either construction or landscaping. The difficulties, though, went far beyond just finding work. I was in my 40s competing with working with guys in my 20s. I had a difficult time finding an apartment because of the record. I had a difficult time with everything. I went on to, I think, be successful. I now own a small business and employ 9 people. I'm in my mid-60s now, and yet the felony conviction still follows me. I still can't go to my grandkids' school events because of the record checks. And it seems to me that once someone has completely, I mean, I can't say turned around because I've only had one arrest in my entire life, and it happened to be for a felony. But anyway, I'm in 60s, and I still can't do so many things that were available to me before. Like I said, simple things like attending my grandkids' school functions. I can't go on trips with the grandkids. The reentry is terrifically difficult. During the 1 year of work release that I served, I was in with probably 50 other guys doing work release, and I was the only person in 1 year that did not violate because of the standards that they were held to. As you said, there's no training for reentry. You're just like buying something, and only the lowest level jobs or entry level jobs were available. Moving into an entry-level job in your 40s was very difficult.
It sounds like, Randy, and I, you know, if any of these questions get intrusive or you're uncomfortable answering them, please honor that impulse. But it seems to me your story is at the heart of a lot of the issues that we're talking about here. So I'd like to – you've added a component here that we haven't talked about, which is in addition to, you know, sort of the housing, economic, the logistical challenges, you're talking about, you know, some real emotional consequences, and, you know, really how it, if I'm not putting words in your mouth, even some, you know, some feelings of self-worth, how that affected you. Was that part is hard for you? As facing sort of the economic, legal, and logistical hurdles of coming back out,
there is emotional. There are grave. There are emotional issues. When your grandkids ask you why you can't come to a school function with them, they weren't even born then. And I certainly don't want to bring up the fact that the reason I can't go is because I was a felon. Still, 25 years later, no one that works for me knows that I was a felon. And I knows that I am a felon. I don't guess you think whatever past tense is ever correct. But, you know, those issues, they ask you about things, and you're constantly hiding. You have to continually hide your past, you know, 25 years later.
Yeah. Well, Randy, thank you for sharing your story with us. And I will say this, whether it means anything to you or not, but I'd say coming from a setback like that and getting to the point where you own your own business and are employing 9 people, that counts as success in my book, if that's worth anything to you.
Well, if I could just add one thing.
Sure.
I would heartily recommend that there be something, some way to seal a record at some point so that, you know, a person can fully integrate into the society and not have a mistake held over them for the rest of their life.
You're getting a lot of nods of heads here of support in the studio, so I'm going to let these folks talk. But thank you again for calling in, Randy.
Thank you.
Rhiannon, I'm going to go with you first.
We do have a very new expungement statute that came into effect, I believe, last year. Mm-hmm. And I don't know all the details of it, and because of the legalities, I don't even really like to try to go into it. But individuals after, you know, a certain amount of time after they've served their sentence or served their probation or parole or whatever it may be, they could be eligible for an expungement where it would seal their record. But it's very specific on very specific time period, very specific to the offense. So the individuals that think that they're eligible for expungement should definitely, you know, look up the statute, contact Neighborhood Christian Legal or
Indiana Legal Services.
And they can help them figure out whether or not they actually can apply to have their record expunged.
Because that sounds like, the point that Randy kept coming back to, and you can tell it is very, very painful for him, is that whole, I can't even go to my grandkids' school events, and I can't even explain to my grandchildren why I can't do that.
The other thing is that not only can you get an expungement, but you can also have your record sealed. That's a little less complicated and convoluted, but there are only some offenses that qualifies for. So there are some things which, once that conviction is actually levied, it is there for the length of a person's lifetime.
We are getting a little bit tight on time. I'm going to try to get a couple more calls in because we do have some people lined up. Marion, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Thank you.
Certainly.
My daughter teaches restorative justice in Oakland, so I've been indoctrinated. But as I was listening to the man who had just left, I wonder if there's a restorative justice component that's working in Marion County. And also I see that you could use it on both ends. Like they go into the schools and present it, but when people leave prison, they go right back to the same situations, might even be the same victims. And, you know, if there was a way that the community, there's been a lot of pain caused, where we could work with the community and work and have an open discussion, like, so you caused me this much pain being my grandson, maybe you come clear my yard for a few weeks and we build a relationship or something, like using restorative justice on both ends.
Okay, let me see if I can get a response. Thanks very much, Mary.
Okay.
Yeah, Indianapolis actually has a fairly robust restorative justice program. Reach for Youth is one of the providers focused on a juvenile population. It's proven to be most effective with juvenile offenders and not as much with adult offenders, mostly because of the level of victimization that happens. But yes, I agree. Restorative justice working with a juvenile population is a great way to get people to move forward.
We are talking about the challenges associated with the reentry of ex-offenders into mainstream society. Robert, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I appreciate the opportunity. My question addresses or raises an issue of disabilities and mental health. of offenders within the correctional system. I have been a Indiana State Parole Officer too many years ago that I care to reference, as well as a counselor at what was the Indiana Boys School, which later became the Indiana Youth Center, I believe, and left the correctional system and moved into private industry. One of the issues that I'm dealing with and many that I know are dealing with currently is the issue of autism. And there are a tremendous number of young people and young adults entering the population right now. Many of them have been convicted of offenses. I'll be visiting a family friend in November in Wisconsin who is on the autism spectrum and who committed a crime in Wisconsin and is serving a 9-year prison sentence. He was committed at that time when he was 17 years old. What is happening to him, at least in Wisconsin, is basically nothing more than containment, and there's no rehabilitation in the context of that system. I don't know what is happening in the state of Indiana, but several of your callers and your panel members have mentioned preparing inmates prior to leaving prison, helping in that transition and so on. And I wonder what attention is being given to, if any, being given to inmates who have autism, specifically high-functioning autism.
Robert, if I could jump in, we're getting close on time, and I want to give them a chance to answer your question. So thank you very much for the call. And, you know, if I could broaden it just a little bit, is part of it, too, that, you know, we have undiagnosed conditions such as autism that go untreated or undealt with Rhiannon.
We actually have a program in partnership with the Department of Correction and Rehab Hospital of
Indiana.
And it's focused on individuals with traumatic brain injury. And before we received this project, I don't think most of us in the criminal justice world realized that traumatic brain injury was very, very apparent in the criminal justice system. So that, I think, is really going to help kind of delve into those issues. Also, that we have a new mental health court here in Indianapolis, and I think that also could help kind of solve some of the issues that caller was just speaking of.
I think that probably will have to be the last word for today. But as always, one of the reasons we call this show No Limits is because the conversations never really end. This is a subject we have talked about before on the program, and we will revisit in the future. I hope you will consider coming back. I'd like to thank my guests, Brian Reeder, Lena Hackett, and Rhiannon Edwards, for what has been a very lively hour. I am John Krall. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.